All right, we'll get started. Okay, so welcome to the last class of the year. So a few logistical things just to get us started. First off, I originally planned to create an extra lecture and upload the audio. I didn't get a chance to do that, so I'm just going to drop that material. So this year, we're not going to cover RSA encryption. Everyone's happy, that's fine. So I'll give you a quick summary of what it's about, but we won't actually talk about it. So this class will do RSA encryption, just a summary. And then I'm going to talk about TLS or HTTPS. And for this protocol, we'll see everything we've learned in the course sort of put together in terms of a single protocol itself. Okay, your assignments are due as well, if you're not slipping. I guess it was kind of a hard assignment, maybe, based on people's some stuff. I can give a few hints. I'm hesitant to do it just because some people have... handed it in already, and so it's sort of beneficial to people who have it. I'll let the music go. So what I'll do is I'll make you a deal. If you've handed in already, and if these hints are really, really helpful, you can take one extra day to hand it in tomorrow if you're not going to slip. If you're going to slip, you still you'll follow the original timeline, which means that you still have an advantage to slipping. You still get an extra day on top of it. So let's see. Okay, so I'll comment on the two most frequent questions I got. So one question is based on part C. So here you're given an encryption of some message, and I'm saying, okay, I want an encryption of the same message. In this question, you don't know what that message is. Okay, if you knew what the message is, that's easy, right? You encrypt it and you'll get a different ciphertext probably. You don't know the decryption key. Okay, I know the decryption key. So you're not going to decrypt it, figure out what the message is, and then re-encrypt it. Not that it really matters, but you don't know my randomness that I use to encrypt this. Okay, so what I'm saying is there is an answer where you don't know M, you don't know D, you don't know what the randomness R is as well, okay? How do you see it? Is it straight out of the notes? No. Did we touch on it in the notes? Yes. If you look at the CCA game, we proved that AlGaMel is not CCA secure. You'll find the answer essentially buried in that proof. So if you follow that proof, that's one place to look. The other thing you can do is just try encrypting the message twice, like just write it out with different notation, and look at like what exactly is different about these two encryptions of the same message, and then figure out how can you go from the one to the other. Okay. So anyway, your hint is you don't have to decrypt it. You don't have to know what the message is. That's sort of what you're going for. Okay. The second question. So there's a lot of confusion. So I'll say a few things without giving answers out. The first thing is that this decision about whether to return a padding error or a MAC error, this is being made by Bob. It's being made by Bob after he's decrypted. Okay, so he's already decrypted. He's now looking at the plain text, and he's making a decision based on what he's seen in terms of the plain text. Okay, so none of this question really has to do with, the MAC or the counter mode or any of that stuff. Okay. The one piece of it that's relevant is, well, first off, the sizes of everything is relevant. And the second is that in counter mode, if you XOR some value in and then you decrypt, you're going to get that same value XORed with the plain text message. Okay. So that's relevant. The rest of it's not particularly relevant. Okay. So it has nothing to do with sort of breaking the encryption or the decryption or how the decryption works. What you'll be able to do with this attack is you'll be able to decrypt the message without knowing the key, okay? That's at the very end of part D, when you get all the way to the bottom, what you'll be able to do is actually just decrypt the entire message, okay? That's where we're going with this particular attack, okay? The attack does have a name. Some people took to researching it. It's called a padding oracle attack. If you're really stuck, you could try and do that. Most of the students that came and talked to me about it were like, they just got more confused as opposed to less confused, because it's not necessarily explained that well. Usually when it's explained with CBC mode, not counter mode. So there are some differences. Counter mode's easier to understand. That's why I chose counter mode. It's not because I was trying to stop you from researching it. But anyways, that is one path forward. Okay. So in part A and part B, the answer really is in part B. Okay. So you can look at part B and you can probably, even without really understanding the question, you can probably write down what happens in terms of part B. Okay. But understanding the consequences of what happens in part B, that's the key to the question. Okay. And so let's just review what happens in part B. Well, Eve flips two bits, okay? And all of a sudden she gets a different error than she did in part A, okay? And the point is that you know, working it out, you know what's under the covers, right? You know that it's padded and there's two bytes of padding, okay? Because that's what the question tells you, okay? But Eve doesn't know that, okay? So Eve was able to change the error type without seeing under the covers. Okay? So what you're going to have to do is put yourself in Eve's shoes and say that I actually don't know that there was two bytes. What can I conclude from the fact that there's a difference between part A and part B? Okay? So part A and part B have different answers, so that's a hint. So if you're getting the same answer for part A and part B, then you're on the wrong track, okay? So they are different, and that different matters. It tells you something. Okay? And what it tells you can use ultimately in part C to figure out how long the padding is. And then once you know how long the padding is, then what you can do is then you can tackle more of the message. So you can move over past the padding to the first MAC, and you can determine what that is, and you can just keep on going. There's no limit to the attack itself. Okay? The final thing that some people asked is that in all of these parts, part C and D, this is a repeated attack. Okay, so you're trying something, you're seeing what the error is, and then you're going to try something else and you're going to see what the error is. Okay, so it's not a one shot where you look at the thing and you know what it decrypts to, or you just ask for one value and you know what it decrypts to. Okay, so you're going to sit there, you're going to try lots of this is a sort of intensive attack. Okay, so you're going to have to try lots of values in order to figure out what's actually decrypting. But actually, at the end of the day, you can decrypt the entire thing. Okay? So anyways, those are some hints. Is there any specific questions beyond that that I can help other than what the answer is? Okay, try your best. Really try and answer part A and part B. I think everyone in this class should be able to get part A and part B. So write down as much as you can about part A and B. I'm starting to get skeptical that maybe not everyone will get all the way through D. That's fine. You know, if nobody gets D, then I'll just drop the marks. But part C, you know, that's where you can think about it. There's actually two ways to answer part C. So one way, I'll tell you the lazy way. And so the lazy way is not going to help you get part D. The lazy way is you can just sort of play with the last block, play with the second last block, play with the third last block, and go all the way. And eventually you will start getting MAC errors. Then you know you hit the MAC. Okay, you moved outside of the padding and you hit the MAC. So that's fine. You can locate sort of where the MAC ends through that mechanism. Okay, but there's a way where you can know exactly. So here's one more hint. For part C, you only have to look at the last byte. You don't have to do anything beyond the last byte itself. Okay, and that. What you do on the last byte will tell you everything you need to know for part C. Yeah. Yeah, so you can think of it either as starting at the end or starting at the start. Let's say you start at the start. If you flip in the first byte, you'll get a MAC error, second byte MAC error, third byte MAC error, because you're flipping the message bytes, right? Eventually, you'll start flipping the MAC bytes, you'll get MAC errors, and then all of a sudden, you're going to get padding error instead. Then you know that you went past the message past the Mac into the Paddy. So the first byte that you flip that gives you that error. That will give you an answer to part C, but that's not the interesting answer. Okay, sure. So yeah. So what does that tell you? When you switch from a MAC error to a padding error, what does that tell you?
That the padding
begins. Yeah, okay. So that's what the question asks, right? Where does the padding begin, essentially? Yeah. That's correct, yeah. So there, you say when the IVs flip, but there's no IV flipping anywhere. So why would you? Yeah. So you're not going to flip the IV. You can take that as a hint if it helps you. If you flip in the CBC Mac, in CBC mode, you have to start flipping IV bits for a reason that doesn't appear at all in the counter mode. Yeah. So you don't have to touch the IV. Okay, other questions? Correct. Yeah. So she'll see two blocks and they'll just look like random numbers. And she'll start flipping bits, and then all of a sudden the type of error she gets will change. That's the only thing she ever sees. She never sees anything beyond I'm getting a MAC error or a padding error. So every time she tries to ask for the decryption of something, she's only getting one bit of information, which is either this failed because the padding was bad, or it failed because of the MAC was bad. Or it succeeded, but it's never going to succeed unless she doesn't change it at all. If she doesn't change it at all, that's the only case where it's going to succeed with overwhelming probability.
Assume that we know the number of padding.
Yep. Yeah, so this attack is going to work byte by byte. So let's say she worked out the padding and she knows it's 10, for example. So she knows it's 10, 10, 10, 10, 10. Another thing she can do is once she knows what the padding is, she can program it to be any value she wants. Okay, so here's the question to ask yourself when you get that far. What if she programs it to be 11, 11, 11? Okay, so there's the last 10 bytes are all 11, and then she starts flipping bits on the last MAC byte, which is would be the 11th byte, right? What value is going to make a difference? So don't answer it, but think about it. That's your hint. Or the hint for everyone when you eventually get there. Yeah, so she'll, correct. She will always get a MAC error, always. Yeah. The MAC will never succeed. So the only advantage she has is sometimes she'll get a padding error before she gets to the MAC error. Okay? And that's going to tell her all she needs to know. Okay? And deciding whether it's a padding error or not is an inspection. I look at the plain text and I make that decision. Okay? So I can only make that decision by looking at the plain text. So by making that decision, I'm actually leaking something about the plain text. Because it's like I looked at the plain text and I saw either a MAC error or a padding error, and I'm telling you which it was. Okay? So that's the high level sort of principle, you know, for a crypto course to take away from this is you are making a decision based on looking at the plain text. Okay? If you decide either A or B, therefore you're leaking something about the plain text. Right, you're telling something about the plain text, okay? And the fact that you can flip bits and then get information about the plain text, you can actually just decrypt the whole plain text. Eventually, yeah. Does it involve, sorry, what? So it involves flipping bits in the ciphertext. So if you, it's not really replacing it. You can think of that as replacing it or flipping the bits. Yeah. Yeah. So part C, just to be clear, if you do it in such a way that it will lead you to the answer to part D, you only have to look at the last byte. Okay. So you're going to do something in the last byte, and it's going to tell you, it's going to tell you everything you need to know. Okay, I'm out of hints. Okay, so yeah, do your best. Write up, even if you don't get the answer, write up sort of as far as you got, and we'll be generous with part marks. Okay, the final exam. So we don't have a lecture tomorrow. I'll mention that as well. So there is a lecture scheduled tomorrow. I'll be traveling. So it will be canceled. The video thing will get canceled as well. So today's lecture will be the last lecture. Yeah. Yeah. So put it in my mailbox. I won't be here. So the TA will fetch it in my mailbox on Wednesday. So don't think that because I'm away, I'm not going to check my mailbox. So the TA marks them. And so he will be going into my mailbox. Yeah. And because he doesn't have a key and he has to get the secretary to open it, if you actually miss the deadline, then you probably won't get it marked because I'm not going to be back until much later. So really make sure that you get it in on time. Okay, yeah, so the final will follow the same template as the midterm. So it'll be short answer. There'll be conceptual questions. You'll be allowed to bring a cheat sheet, just like in the midterm. You can put anything on it, single-sided, normal letter size, 8.5 by 11, can be as small as you want. It's just single-sided to stop you from flipping because that's loud and noisy. The rooms are, for this class, it's too big to fit in one room, so there's two rooms that are assigned. Some years I'll email, like, put you in either room A or B. Other years you just show up to one of the rooms, and if it's full, we'll direct you to the other. Probably, it will probably be the latter. If I get really inspired, I'll send an email. If I do assign you and you show up and you haven't seen the email, it will be posted on the doors and things like that. So just show up to one of the two rooms and you'll find yourself in the right place. It will be a little longer than the final exam. So than the midterm. So the midterm was 4 questions. So you can expect maybe 8 questions, something like that for the final. The final will be comprehensive, meaning it will cover the entire course. So this is sort of a university requirement that final exams be comprehensive of the entire course for formal reasons. If the course has to get reevaluated or something like that, they do reserve the right to just look at your final and make that representative of your entire mark. So that's why it has to be comprehensive. I'm not out to really test you hard on the pre-midterm material. I want you to concentrate on the post-midterm material, but I will ask at least one question that will be straight from the pre-midterm material. And some of the post-midterm material, I mean, we see hash functions and things like that again. So those concepts do show up again. And so you can expect to see pre-midterm material also in that form, in the form that it shows up again in the post-midterm material. Questions about it? You can bring a calculator if you want it. You shouldn't need it. You won't need it. So for the final exam, I don't have a good set of sample questions. I have previous questions for midterms, but I never gave a cheat sheet I can give them to you, but they're things like they're more memorization-based questions, and so you're going to get the wrong impression from them. So I'm kind of scared to give them to you because I think that you'll study them, and then you'll think that the questions are going to look a little bit different. So with a cheat sheet, the previous question should be actually very, very easy because they're just sort of straight out of the notes. So I don't have a good set of questions to give to you, unfortunately. So I won't commit to giving you sample questions. You can look at all the previous midterm questions to get that sort of template, because they're all online. Other questions? Okay, the assignment itself, because it's due now, I'll hand it back at the final. It's way harder than anything you'll be asked on the final exam as well. So just like assignment one didn't really help you with the midterm, assignment two won't help you with the final. If you really want to know what the right answers are before the final, I'll try and post the solution to the website. But don't worry about understanding assignment two in order to understand the final exam. Other questions? Okay. If you think of something, you can always ask after the break. Okay. So we'll go into the final lecture. Okay. So what we did is, up till now, we've been looking at the integers mod p. And specifically, we looked at three algorithms. The first is we looked at Diffie-Hellman, or station-to-station, which is Diffie-Hellman with signatures. So this is what we call a key exchange, key agreement protocol. We'll distinguish those two terms in a few minutes. We looked at ElGamel. ElGamel is public key encryption. ElGamel is CPA secure. Okay. In general, if we're going to use public key encryption, we're going to make it CCA secure. There is a way to make ElGamel CCA secure. It turns out that because Diffie-Hellman is so powerful, no one really uses ElGamel ever. Sometimes in PGP, I think you can use ElGamel, which is for encrypted emails, but essentially, no one uses ElGamel. If you want to use encryption, you're going to use something called RSA, which has a CCA secure variant of it, which I'll talk about. I'm not going to show you how it works, but I'll mention its existence in a second. But I'll just note that this isn't CCA secure. And then we talked about DSA and Schnorr, which are two signature schemes that are very similar to each other. Okay, now there's another setting. So historically, what happened is we had this Diffie-Hellman protocol that came out first. So it came out in the late 70s, I think 77 or 78. And it worked in the integers mod p. Now, ElGamel didn't exist. ElGamel came out along years later. Okay, but this idea of public key encryption, people knew like that was something that would be desirable, okay, that you would encrypt under one key and you'd have a different decryption key. So when Diffie-Hellman came out, a lot of people said, well, is there a way that we can do public key encryption using this sort of this number theory based math, okay? And so the first system that did it is called RSA encryption. So it came out a year later. And Diffie-Hellman's a very significant breakthrough, but RSA is probably considered the more significant breakthrough. For example, the three people, the R, the S, and the A, it stands for three people, Ravesh, Shamir, and Edelman. They won the Turing Award, which is like the Nobel Prize for computer science for RSA. I don't believe Diffie-Hellman won it for Diffie-Hellman, although I could be mistaken on that. So the integers mod p, Diffie-Hellman was based on this discrete log problem, or the variant of it called the decisional Diffie-Hellman problem. Okay, when Ravesh, Shamir, and Edelman tried to come up with public key encryption, they found something that's very, very close, but it's not exactly the same. So it's the integers mod n, where n equals p times q, where these are two prime numbers. Okay, so the integers mod n so you pick two prime numbers. You can think of them as safe prime if you want. So you pick two safe primes. You multiply them together. Now you have this n. N's called a composite because it's composed of two primes. And then you're going to work mod that. Okay. Now it turns out that basically a lot of the same properties hold. It's still kind of groupish. You can't necessarily strictly invert every element. So technically it's not a group, but it multiplication works. It's closed under multiplication. You can do exponentiation. Exponentiation works. The discrete log problem is still probably hard. You have to be a little careful how you choose P and Q. But for RSA, what they found is that in addition to finding discrete logs being hard, finding square roots or n roots of any number, we'll call them x roots, that's also hard in this setting. Okay, so when you're working mod P, it's not hard. When you switch to mod n, it's hard because when you want to take a root, you have to invert it in the exponent group. And the size of the exponent group is going to be a function of P and Q. Okay? It's specifically going to be P minus 1 times Q minus 1. And in order to know that, you have to figure out, you have to look at n and you have to figure out what are the two prime numbers that when you multiply them together give you this number n. Okay, that's called factoring. So factoring is a hard problem when P and Q are big enough. Okay, so if you have a number that's simply the product of two other numbers, figuring out what those two numbers are that when multiplied together give you that number, that's hard. Okay, you can try every number and keep dividing them off until you get an integer instead of a decimal. That's one approach. But in general, there's no real good algorithm for solving that particular problem, okay? Like the discrete log problems, there's algorithms that are a little faster than exhaustive search. They have about square root complexity. But anyways, okay, so the integers mod n is a thing. We would go through all the math, but we're skipping that. From this setting, we also get two algorithms. We get an LGMEL-style encryption scheme, and we get a signature scheme that's similar to DSA or Schnorr. We don't have a Diffie-Hellman equivalent in the RSA setting, okay? So we have what's called RSA encryption. Okay, and RSA encryption is only OTS secure. It's not even CPA secure. So that means it's deterministic. Sometimes this is called textbook RSA. It's because there's different variants of it. But the original RSA is completely deterministic. What does that mean? It means if you encrypt the same message twice, you get the same answer. Okay? You still can't decrypt it. You can't look at the answer and decrypt it. Okay? So it's sort of secure, but it does have that property. So it's similar to ECB mode for encryption. Okay? Now there's a padding scheme that you can add to the ending. There's actually two, but the most secure one's called OAEP. And RSA plus OAEP is CCA secure. Okay, so not only is it CPA secure, where now when you encrypt messages twice, you actually choose a random number when you do this padding. So it's a special padding that's non-deterministic. And it also has a kind of MAC kind of feature, where if you go flipping bits, it's going to give you errors as opposed to just decrypting. So what this will do is it will give you CCA secure. Okay. And similarly, there's a signature scheme. It's called RSA signatures. And there's a variant called RSA plus PSS, which is padding, which is... I know it's secure signature. I forget what the P stands for. And we didn't really talk about security definitions for signature schemes, but there are different definitions, and this reaches the highest level of security. Which is, it's unforgeable against chosen message attacks. Chosen signature attacks, I guess. Okay. So anyway, just know of the existence of two things called RSA. Now, RSA and the discrete log, integers mod p and mod n, they were interchangeable for years. Okay, there was no reason to really prefer one to the other. So different protocols would use Diffie-Hellman, or they would use RSA encryption. And then if you open up something that's signed, it would just as commonly be signed with DSA as it would with RSA. Okay. Then what happened, as I mentioned, people discovered that instead of doing the integers mod p, you can do it over these elliptic curves, and you get the same level of security, but everything's way smaller and it's way faster. Okay. Now, elliptic curves is an optimization that works for the integers mod p. So everything you do in the integers mod p, you can do over elliptic curves. RSA, you can't do over elliptic curves. Okay. So basically, integers mod p, integers mod, or mod n, they sort of started out with the same level of efficiency. We found a super fast way to do integers mod p. We didn't find the equivalent for integers mod n. And so RSA is now basically being phased out. People aren't really using it because the numbers are so big and it's so slow. Everyone's switching over to the elliptic curve versions of both Diffie-Hellman and DSA. And then if you want to do encryption, you would use an AlGaMal variant that was actually CCA secure. But for reasons that we're about to talk about, most people, it turns out you don't really need public key encryption. If you have these other two primitives, they're good enough for what you want to do. So elliptic curves are faster. So if you want to do a modular exponentiation or the elliptic curve equivalent, it takes less time. And the numbers that you're operating on are smaller. So when you write a signature down, and I'll show you what a signature looks like written down in a second, it's just shorter. It takes less bits to describe it. And it's as safe and secure. Yeah. So there's no, as far as we know anyways, there's no security reason not to use it. Yeah, so that we'll get to in a second. Yeah, so I haven't explained that yet. Okay, one other thing that I'm just thinking when I see the highest level of security here, I don't know if we ever actually formally defined what it means for a signature to be secure. We sort of had an intuitive definition. So let me quickly define that, and then so this is sort of an aside that you can kind of move back in the notes to when we were talking about signatures. So recall that a signature on message M is some value, we'll call it sigma. So if you see a message and a signature lying around and you want to change the message in any ways, even if it's as small as one bit, you shouldn't be able to generate the new signature value, okay, without knowing the secret key, okay? So this is called unforgeability. And it's essentially the same as a MAC. So the MAC has a similar security definition. Now, when you go into more detail than this, there are games, just like in the CPA game and the CCA game, where you're allowed to give messages, and then it will give you signatures on those messages, and then you have to try and generate incorrect signatures. So there is this sort of game that's set up, but we're not going to go into that much detail for signature schemes. Okay. So the final topic I want to talk about is putting everything together. So we saw all these primitives, block ciphers, stream ciphers, max, extractors, hash functions, signature functions, Diffie-Hellman, public key. Why do we need them all? Do we need all of them? What when we have all of them available at our fingertips, what does that actually allow us to do? What's the end product? So what we're trying to do is something that I'll call secure transport. There's different names for it. Okay. And what we want to do is we basically want to make a secure channel between two parties. So we have Alice and we have Bob. We want this sort of secure channel where Alice can drop messages into it and Bob can receive them, and vice versa. Bob can send them back to Alice. Okay. If there's an adversary in the middle, it doesn't matter. So Eve cannot read or modify messages. Technically, she can modify them, but it will just generate an error, and Bob will say he'll be able to detect modification. And what do we need to set this whole thing up? So we went through these different iterations where Alice and Bob had to meet in a back alley, they had to exchange keys, and then we went to a different scenario where we had public keys and all of that type of thing. So at the very end of the day, all Alice needs is Bob's public key. Okay. So we have a public key for Bob. Okay. And if Alice has it, then that's enough to set up the secure channel. Okay. And the secure channel will be very fast, and you can send lots of data over it, you know, gigabytes of data, and it's not going to be that much slower than just sending it in plain text. Okay. That's the sort of promise. Okay. And so we can set this all up. All we need is the public key of Bob. Okay, that's the design goal. Okay, now how are we going to combine all of these primitives to actually allow us to do this? Okay, so the first assumption we're making is that the promise of this course is you can do it assuming you can get Bob's actual public key, okay? But a natural question you might ask is, well, how do I know that it's actually Bob's public key? Maybe Bob puts it on his website, but when I go to visit the website, how do I know that someone was in the middle and changed that value, right? And then maybe I have an encrypted channel to the website, but then how do I get the public key of the website in order to have that encrypted channel that's going to allow me to get Bob's public key without it being changed? Okay, so there's a sort of circular argument. And so at the end of the day, how you get Bob's public key is something that crypto can't help you solve. Okay, so all we can say in crypto is if you're able to get Bob's public key, then we can do everything else. Okay, everything else will work. You can have a secure channel. But how you get Bob's public key is still a really hard problem, okay? So we'll talk more about this in a security course because it's really a security question as opposed to a crypto question. So for some of you, 6150 is a required course. So in that course, we spend a long time, about two or three lectures talking about this exact problem. How does Alice get Bob's public key, okay? And in particular, let's think about the web. So pretend Alice is you're Alice, and Bob is, I don't know, Gmail, right? So if I go to gmail.com, I'm going to have an encrypted connection. And somehow I knew Google's public key. Okay, so I knew that that was Google's public key. How did I learn that? How did I know that that was actually Google's public key? If the adversary was in the middle, right, why couldn't she just put her own key in and say, this is Google's public key? Now I would think it was the adversary's key, and then I would end up making my secure channel to the adversary instead of all the way to Google. Okay, so the short answer is that your computer, when you buy it, I go to the Apple store and I buy this, I turn it on for the very first time, It comes pre-programmed with the public keys of a bunch of organizations called certificate authorities, and they're the ones that sign Google's public key, okay? So that's how that problem gets solved in practice, at least in the case of web browsing, is that my computer comes with, it actually turns out it comes trusting about 200 to 600 different organizations or companies that are allowed to go around signing people's keys, okay? And that's a really messy solution, and there's all sorts of problems with that solution, and we'll talk about that more in 6150, okay? But that's how this particular problem gets solved, okay? But for this course, we're just going to assume that okay, somehow we're connected to Google, we're seeing a public key, we know that that's actually Google's public key. Now, how can we actually get our email sent to us securely so that Eve, who's sitting in the middle, can't intercept it, okay? We're going to send our password across, so if Eve was in the middle, she could read our password if there was no encryption. Then our inbox is going to come down, so Eve could read all our email if there was no encryption. So we really need this secure channel between the two of them. Okay. Now, there's one other question. And that question is, we're assuming that we know Bob's public key. Okay. What kind of key is that? So we know that we have... we know that we can do Diffie-Hellman, and for Diffie-Hellman, there's no keys, okay? We're determining a symmetric key, but it's not secure. It's not secure if Eve's in the middle. So we use station-to-station. Station-to-station adds a signature, okay? So we do need a key for the signature itself, okay? If we use AlGaMel, that's an encryption algorithm, okay? And if we use DSA or Schnorr, those are signature algorithms, okay? So encryption and... encryption and signature schemes both have public keys, okay? So what do we need to know about Bob in order to set up this channel? Do we need both an encryption public key and a signature public key? Or can we work with one and not the other? And if we can work with one and not the other, does it matter which we have? Does it matter if what we have is a signature key or if we have an encryption key? Okay, so it turns out that we only need one of the two. He doesn't have to have both a public key that's for encryption and signature. And it doesn't matter which of the two we have, but the protocol that we use will be different. Okay, so there's one protocol that we'll use if we have an encryption key, and there's one protocol that we'll use if we have a signature scheme. Okay, and the security properties are slightly different. Okay. So PKB is an encryption public key. We're going to do something called key transport. And if it's a signature scheme, we're going to do what's called key agreement, which is essentially Diffie-Hellman. Okay, now if I have a public key encryption scheme for Bob, then I'm sort of done, right? I can just start taking my data, I can encrypt it under Bob's key, and I can give it to him, and then, you know, if my data is too big to fit, then I'll just send multiple messages, okay? So what's wrong with that approach? Well, there's two things that are wrong with that approach. The first thing is that we need some integrity, okay? So confidentiality is not enough. So public key encryption doesn't give you any integrity. So we saw that AlGaMel, for example, is malleable. So what Eve could do is start flipping things around, and even though she can't decrypt things, she's able to change the messages, okay? The second thing is that public key crypto is really slow, all right? So what we'd ideally like is we would like it so that we could actually use symmetric key encryption just because it's faster, Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to use public key encryption to get Alice and Bob to know a symmetric key. Okay. So far they've never met, they've never talked, so they don't share a symmetric key. So what we're going to do is we're going to use public key encryption. That's going to get us a symmetric key. And then once we have a symmetric key, we're just going to use block ciphers and max and stream ciphers or whatever the case may be in order to actually do the bulk transfers back and forth between them. Okay, so we'll get them to agree on symmetric keys. So, for example, an AES key and a MAC key. And then once we have AES and a MAC key, then they can use AES in some sort of mode of operation, such as CPA, with a MAC, like, say, HMAC. And then that whole thing is CCA secure. Or we can get them a GCM key, then they can just use AES GCM. Then they only need one key instead of two keys. Okay. Okay, so let's break these down step by step. So step one. Okay, so assuming that we have Bob's encryption key, we're going to do something called key transport. All right, so step one is get a symmetric key, a shared symmetric key. Or more than one. Okay, so key transport recall is when PKB is an encryption key as opposed to a signature key. Okay, how do we do it? Really simple protocol. All we're going to do is we have Alice and we have Bob. Alice is going to choose an AES key that they're both going to use. And it can be as long as she wants. For example, it might be 128 bits for encryption and 128 bits for the MAC. But we'll just describe it as K. Okay. Then what she'll do is she'll encrypt K under Bob's public key. Send it to Bob. Bob will decrypt it. And he'll get K. Now both parties have K, and so they can go ahead and they can start using AES or whatever the case may be. Okay. Now the alternative is, let's say, let's say that we only have Bob's signature key, okay? If we have a signature key for Bob, we can't do this. We can't encrypt our key. We can't just choose a key and send it across because we need, that's encryption, okay? He only has a signature key, okay? So we're going to do something different. So what can we do if all we have is Bob's signature key? In this case, we can use Diffie-Hellman. So in Diffie-Hellman or station-to-station, the secure version of Diffie-Hellman, you only need a signature key. You don't need an encryption key. So what Alice will do is she'll choose, you know, some exponent, and she'll send G to the A. Bob will choose an exponent, send G to the B. Both parties will compute G to the AB. Okay. Now, G to the AB, as we talked about, you can't use that straight up as an AES key or a MAC key because not every single key is in the group that defines all the things that are in G to the AB. So G to the AB is a random number, but it's a random number in this group of integers that's a subgroup of all possible integers. So what we have to do is we want to map it to a universally random string, so we're going to use an extractor. And that will give us K. Okay, so the end result, whether you do key transport or key agreement, is both parties at the end of the day, they end up with this value K. K is an L-bit integer, it's uniformly random. So the end result is the same. So if we treat this as a black box, a public key goes in, K comes out, it sort of doesn't matter which of the two you use. Okay, so you can choose between the two. Now, if you look at these two protocols, which would you rather do? Okay, so some people are saying the first, some people are saying the second. So of the people who like the first one, why? Okay, so it's definitely easier. It's faster. Why is it faster? Okay, so it's one way. So there's no round trip, right? You just choose a key, you send it, done. Both parties have it. With Diffie-Hellman, it's like you have to send a message, then you're going to wait for a reply to it. Okay, so let's say you're Google and you have Gmail up, and think of all the millions of people that are connecting to you every second, right? If you add up those round trips across all of that, that does add up to a substantial amount. Maybe you don't care when you're just visiting one website, it's a difference of milliseconds. But when you're on the other end and you're the server and you're serving up millions and millions of people, like little things like this can make a difference. Okay, so key transport is far more efficient. Okay, so let me just say that the end product of KT and I'll call this KA. So there's no round trip. Okay, is there any reason that we might like key agreement? So some people thought key agreement was better. Was there an argument for that?
It's because you don't send the keys outside. It's calculated both for
you. Okay, so the security looks maybe a little different. Here, K is going across the wire. It is under encryption. Here, K never goes across the wire. What difference does that make? Does that make any substantial difference in the end? Okay, so that seems to be the case, yeah. So why? Can we articulate why? Right, right. Yeah, so it definitely seems like that would be a more safe thing to do. So in both cases, as long as you know the correct public key, then it's fine. Actually, sorry, I forgot a big step in this, which is to actually use the public key. So there's going to be a signature by Bob on both G to the A and G to the B. Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, so, okay, sorry. Yeah, so with this modification. Now notice that this is still, you can send these two values together, so it's not an extra round of communication, but I just split it out. Okay, any other? Okay, so we feel like this is still sort of more secure somehow. Okay, let's say I'm an adversary and I'm watching Alice and Bob talk for a year. And so I'm writing down everything I see. I can't decrypt it because it's encrypted, but I'm at least writing down what they see, okay? And this is sort of a realistic threat model, right? The NSA built this big data center to log lots of data. We don't know exactly what they're storing, but you might infer that they're writing down
everything
that they see, even if it's encrypted or not. So let's say we have, a year of Alice and Bob talking, okay? And let's say that after a year, for whatever reason, I break into Bob's computer, or he gets malware or something like that, and I learn what PKB is. Okay, so a year later, I know what PKB is. Okay, what can I do? Let's start with key transport. So in key transport, assuming that after the end of this fraud, they turn around, they use this K value to start encrypting. So because I know PKB, do I know K? So if I write down every C, right? So I write down every encryption of K. It's encrypted under PKB. Sorry, I stated it wrong. But answer the question I asked just to make sure we're correct. If I know KPB, obviously, yeah, that doesn't tell me anything about K. If I know SKB, the secret key that corresponds to this public key encryption, then what can I do? Okay, so I can decrypt all the Cs that I've seen. What do I get now? I get all the Ks, right? Now that I have all the Ks, then I can decrypt all the things that were decrypted, okay? So if I write down all the information between Alice and Bob, and then all of a sudden I lose control of my secret key, then all my past communication can be decrypted, okay? Now let's look at key agreement. Same question, same scenario. So I watch Alice and Bob do key agreement for a year, and I write down all the values. So I write down every G to the A value and every G to the B value and every signed value. And now all of a sudden I know the secret key that corresponds to the signature scheme. Okay. Do I know all the Ks? Why not? Okay, so K never went through. Okay. All I can do, what can I do? I can sign things now, okay? So I can, going forward, if they send G to the A's and B's, I can change those values and I can sign them because now I know the correct key, okay? So for forward communication after the compromise, I can compromise all of the communication, okay? But for past communication, I can't compromise it, okay? So with key transport, once I know the secret key that corresponds to this, I can break all past communication where I wrote down the values, and I can break all future values because if people keep sending it under this key, then I can decrypt it, okay? With key agreement, I can only break forward communications. I can't break any backward communication backward in time, okay? So there is an actual security difference where you get something for the extra rounds in key agreement. Yeah.
So what technologies?
Yep, so TLS will use both. So you actually get to choose which of the two you use. And so if you want it to be fast, you might use key transport. If you want it to be more secure, you might use key agreement. And now that people are really worried about private keys being compromised in the long run, almost everyone's saying you should do key agreement.
So Signal
is. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So they'll use, something even a little more complicated than Diffie-Hellman, but it has that property that we just talked about.
Can there be
No. Yeah. So you calculate a private key, and then there'll be one public key that corresponds to it. You could set up a crypto scheme that had that property if you wanted to, but in all of the standard crypto schemes, they all have the property that there's one public key per private key.
And in the key agreement process at the end, you encrypt the message using
Exactly. So I haven't shown that yet, but yeah, that's what will happen.
Speaking, A can encrypt and decrypt its own message.
That's right. Yeah. So with symmetric key encryption, Alice can encrypt and decrypt. With public key encryption, it's like even if you're the person encrypting it, once you encrypt it, you can't go back. But you can always start with what you started with and go forward and see it comes out to the same answer. So if you wanted to prove to someone else that you actually encrypted a particular message, even though you couldn't decrypt it, you could show them the message and the randomness that you used to do it. But yeah, with symmetric key, yeah, you can both encrypt and decrypt. Okay. So key transport is faster than key agreement, but key agreement is more secure. Okay, so if you break the secret key that's affiliated with a public key, you can do bad things. So let's assume that this is sort of time, and we compromise the key here. So for key transport, basically all your past communication before the compromise plus everything after will be insecure. For key agreement, everything after the compromise will be insecure, but the things before it will remain secure. Okay. So if you are compromised, then what you have to do is you have to switch your key. So then you just choose a new key, then you have to publish it and get everyone to see that it's the key's been changed, and that ends up being a whole nightmare to do. But anyways, assuming you can do that, now you have a new key, then both will be secure going forward. Yeah. Yeah. So what I would do is, if I'm in SKB, Alice would send G to the A. I would change that to G to the A prime, where I know A prime. Then Bob would send G to the B. I would change that to G to the B prime. And then I can sign, because I know the signature, I can sign so I would just sign my G to the B that I changed, and I would include Alice's original G to the A, even though Bob got a different G to the A. Then I do the classic man in the middle attack. Yeah. Okay, and this has a name, so this is called perfect forward secrecy, this particular property. Sometimes it's called backward security, which actually kind of makes more sense. But anyways, the original name was perfect forward secrecy. All right, so Diffie-Hellman, just to emphasize it. So it has perfect forward secrecy and key transport is not. Yeah. Sure. Okay, so this is, once again, this is sort of raising about the crypto. It's more going to a security level. So first off, what does a key look like? So a key is a large random number, 1,024 bits or something like that. Maybe it's 256 bits. And you cannot memorize it. It's too long to memorize. So that means you need to write it down. So where are you going to store it? Well, for every connection that's connecting, say, to Google, people are sending keys to Google. So Google has to have that online. It has to be on the server, because on the fly, they're going to be decrypting these keys, getting the keys out, and then switching over. Similarly, for key agreement, every time they send a GB, they have to sign it. So that key has to be sitting there on that server. So it's sitting on every server that can run TLS. So if you can break into the server, or you work at the company and you have administrative rights to the server, or whatever the case may be, then you're able to obtain that value. And so that's how in practice it would get compromised. So it's not that uncommon for these keys to get compromised. Okay. And notice too that in this case, with key transport, Alice has no control over it, right? So Alice is sending these messages back and forth with Google. It's Google's problem. If they get their key compromised, all of a sudden all of Alice's information between her and Google is compromised as well, right? So now Google is going to be one of the last companies to get their keys compromised, probably because they have really good security because they're such a big company. But if you think of Concordia server, right? It's still very, very secure, but we'll see how secure it is in a second. But it's maybe more likely to get compromised than say Google's or something like that. Okay.
Should I trust self-signed certificate from Concordia?
No. What you should do is phone up AITS and ask them if it's the right key or not. No one actually does that. Okay, so this is step one. So we do step one. So we're either going to do key transport or key agreement. And so that's going to get us a shared key. So we start off, Alice has PKB. She's either going to do key agreement or she's going to do key transport. The end product will be the same. We have a shared key. Okay. And then what we're going to do is we're going to do symmetric key encryption. And we're going to make it CCA secure. So that's just a fancy way of saying it's secure. Not just is it confidential, but if you change bits, you'll be able to detect that as well. Okay, so we're going to add a MAC to it or use some other mode of operation. Okay, so this is what we were calling step one. This is what we are calling step two. Okay, so K, we call it a master secret. Why do we call it a master secret? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to use it as a seed to a pseudo-random number generator to generate all the keys that we need. Okay, so we only need K to be long enough so that a seed is secure. A seed that's secure would be something like 112 bits, okay? Then if we need more than 112 bits, let's say we're doing both encryption and a MAC, we actually need twice as much, then we can expand it out and we can get 256 bits from that 112-bit seed. So this is just a process where you don't have to worry about how big K is. So it's a good question. So first off, can you use K directly? Yes, you can use K directory directly. What will happen is in SSL or TLS, you're able to negotiate whether you want to do key agreement or key transport. And you're also going to be able to negotiate how you want to do this. And what they decided is they don't want you, when you're negotiating this, to have to know how you're going to do this, okay? So For example, let's say that you do this with encryptions in Max, you're going to need two keys instead of one. If you do GCM, you just need one key, okay? So the question is, how big should K be coming out of here? Well, it's going to depend on whether you need a MAC key or if you're just going to do GCM. So what they said is, forget about that. K will always come out the same size. Then we'll take K, we'll run it through a PRG, and we'll get as many keys as we want. And then we don't have to, this side of the step one doesn't have to care about what step two is doing. So it's basically just for sort of encapsulation. That's why. Yeah. Okay. And so generally, what we will do is we'll get a set of keys. And the exact set will depend on. What is being used? Okay, so for example, one thing we might do is we might do encryptions plus MAC. So here we have Alice, we have Bob. Alice will generate an encryption key and a MAC key from the shared secret. Bob has the same shared secret, so he can generate the same set of keys. Okay, and then they'll do the algorithm itself. Correct.
So, and it depends on the device that A has and B has. So, the key
So, no, so a pseudo random number generator is deterministic. So, it depends only on the seed. Maybe what you're thinking about is where we get the seed from. So, in this case, the seed was chosen through Diffie-Hellman, but you could rewind that question all the way back to here, which is, you know, Alice is generating this random exponent that will eventually become the seed that goes through the PRG. How do you know that Alice's random number generator was good when she generated this key? Or here, she generates the K straight up, right? And there could be all sorts of problems. So if Alice doesn't have good randomness, she could choose a garbage key here, and then the whole thing will break down as a result of that. Okay, so you do your encrypt and MAC algorithm. I won't write out the whole thing, but you're just going to encrypt with them. So what SSL does is, or TLS, depending on the version, basically the MAC is going to be an HMAC, and your encryption is going to be one of three options. So they'll give you CBC mode, they'll give you counter mode, or they'll give you a stream cipher. CBC mode is used with either AES. You might see triple DES or DES. So these are old and you shouldn't use them, but they are still part of the standard for SSL. This one's okay. AES is what you want to see. And for the stream cipher, what you'll see is RC4 or CHA-CHA-20. CHA-CHA-20 is great. RC4 is insecure as well. Okay, and I'll show you some websites and we'll look and see what they're actually using. Okay, similarly with counter mode, you're going to use one of these three block ciphers. Yeah. Yeah. So let's go back to this. Okay. So what can we say about this value g to the ab? So we know it's a member of GQ, okay? Now the question is every number in GQ? And so it turns out that not every number is in GQ. So for example, the number 2 might be in GQ and the number 3 might be in it, but maybe the number 4 isn't and the number 5 is, okay? Now, given that the fact that the number 4 doesn't happen to be in GQ, that means your AES key will never be the number 4, okay? We don't want that. We want every AES key to be possible. So we run it through the extractor, and that's what the extractor does. Does that make sense? Okay, so in this case, we have 2 keys. Now, what SSL will actually do, I won't write it down, is when Alice sends messages to Bob, she'll use one set of keys. And when Bob sends them back, you'll use a different set of keys. So you actually end up with 4 keys. But there's no like really strong security benefits that you get from it. Okay. Now, the other thing we might do is we might use a CCA secure mode of operation. So we might use authenticated encryption. And so here we won't have a MAC. What we'll do is we'll send the encryption under 1K. So the K we can just use straight up, but for encapsulation reasons, we usually run it through the PRG, even though it doesn't really do anything. Okay, and because we have no MAC, this has to be CCA secure. And so this would be GCM mode, which is only ever used with AES because GCM is a new addition to TLS. And by that time, they had said stop using DES and stop using triple DES. So you'll only ever see GCM used with AES, although technically you could use it with any block cipher. In the future, there is a process to standardize a new alternative to GCM, and so we might start seeing differences between this. I'll note here as well, I forgot to mention it, but the HMAC has a hash function in it. So what hash function do we use? So you might see MD5, you might see SHA-1, and you might see SHA-2 or 256. There's another one, Poly 1305, which is actually a MAC algorithm beyond. It's not an HMAC. It's a different way of doing a MAC. You only ever see that once Google uses it with ChaCha20, so I'm not going to write it, but there are a few things that I'm not writing. MD5 is not secure. SHA-1's not secure against collisions. Technically, HMAC is still secure. Shouldn't use it anyways to be safe. And then SHA-256 is fine. And you might see SHA-3 as well. Let me do this like this. And then I'll add SHA-3. SHA-256 is SHA-2-256 or SHA-2-255-12 as well. Okay, so if you use GCM, then you don't need a MAC. It has a MAC essentially built in. Okay, so this is the whole process. So you get Bob's public key. You decide whether you're doing key agreement or key transport. You end up with a share key. Then you decide whether you're using a MAC or not. Are you going to use GCM? If not, you're going to use a MAC and your encryption. And you can decide whether you're going to use a stream cipher or a block cipher. If you're using a block cipher, you're going to use CBC mode or counter mode or whatever the case may be. All of this is negotiated in plain text. Okay? So Alice will say, this is what I want to use. And the server will say, great, I can use 3 of those 5 things. I don't know about the other 2. And then they'll end up using 1 of them. Okay, so we'll talk about that negotiation when we talk about actual SSL. But we're long overdue for a break, so let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and talk about putting this stuff together. Okay, so what we're going to do, if everyone can take their seats. All right, we're going to talk about the HTTPS protocol. So HTTPS stands for HTTP, which you probably all know from typing URLs in, over what's called SSL or TLS. HTTP is just a network protocol. It allows you to send websites back and forth. SSL TLS is the crypto. So it's crypto that's added on top. You can do other things other than HTTP over SSL TLS. So if you want to do email over it, you can do secure message transfer. If you want to do SSH or secure file transport over it, SSH uses a slightly different protocol. You can do other things over SSL TLS. Okay, but we'll focus just on HTTP because it's the most common. SSL and TLS are the same protocol. They're just sort of older versions. So the original was called SSL. It was developed by Netscape in like the 90s. And so they called it SSL. There were two versions of it. And then Netscape handed it over because Netscape's a company. They said, let's make this so it's cross-company. So they changed the name to TLS. An organization called the IETF took it over. And there's a bunch of versions. So there's 1.0, 1.1, 1.2. This is the latest, and 1.3 is being standardized now. Okay, there's problems with SSL 2.0 and 3.0 that are very severe. There's problems with TLS 1.0 that are somewhat severe. They're severe in a few cases, not in all cases. 1.1, basically, what happened is 1.0 came out, then 1.1 came out, and nobody upgraded. Everyone stayed at 1.0. Then 1.2 came out, and no one upgraded. Everyone stayed at 1.0. Then there was a bunch of security flaws with 1.0, and so everyone upgraded to 1.2. So it's very rare to find someone that supports 1.1 that doesn't support 1.2. But 1.2 is pretty good. There's a few minor issues with it, and then 1.3 will presumably fix everything, and it will be secure forever. Not exactly, but anyways. Okay, so this is web protocol, and this is encrypted. Okay, and what it is it's giving you this exact secure tunnel. In particular, what it's giving you is what we call single authentication as opposed to double authentication, where Alice knows she's talking to Bob. Bob doesn't know who Alice is. Bob has no idea who Alice is, okay? So think of the scenario where you go to Google. You care a lot about that you're going to Google. Google doesn't know who you are, okay? At least not when you form this connection. Then they might ask you for a username password. That's how you'll authenticate back. So that's stuff that's being sent inside this tunnel, but it's not the tunnel itself. There is a protocol for what's called mutual authentication, where both Alice and Bob have public keys. They both have certificates. They both know each other's certificate authorities. Then you can set up a mutually authenticated protocol. It's almost never used. Maybe in some corporate environments you might see it, but you don't see it on the web ever. So what do we say about this tunnel? So we have confidentiality, meaning encrypted messages are encrypted. We have message integrity, meaning that messages are MACed. So if they're changed, you'll detect it. If Bob detects it, then he'll just say, send it again. I don't know what happened. Something happened in the middle, but I know it's not right. And then the third thing is that we, HTTPS strives to give you what's called server authentication, which just means that you know Bob's public key. How this happens, we're not dealing with in this course. We're just dealing with 1 and 2. In this course, and then for 3, you can take 6150 if you want to learn more about that. So this is the question of how Alice knows Bob's public key. And like I said, it sort of comes on your computer. Your computer comes with a bunch of information even when you buy it for the first time. Okay, so here's sort of the scenario. So imagine, for example, we have Concordia.ca. And so Concordia will have a bunch of people that are connected to it at one time. So Alice, Bob, Carol will all be connected to it. And all of these people will also be connected to other servers at the same time. even if you're just on concordia.ca, you'll be pulling an image down from somewhere else, or you'll be pulling JavaScript down from somewhere else, or Concordia is going to be sending your data off to Google to track for them or whatever. So you'll invariably be connected to a bunch of servers, okay? And all of these have their own keys, okay? The public key is the same. So Concordia will negotiate all of these connections using its same public key, but once you get to step two of this protocol and you switched over to symmetric key, every single one of these connections has its own unique key. So Alice and Concordia have a key. Bob and Carol, and they all have keys. And if Alice is connected to Concordia and she's connected to somewhere else, she's going to have a totally different key, called K1 prime. So basically all these connections, they all have their own symmetric keys that have been negotiated. Okay, so how does this start? So I'll draw kind of a flow chart, and then I'll show you, I'll open up a browser and we'll look at it in action. Okay, so there's a certificate, which we talked about a little bit. That's basically the servers. I'm gonna stop calling them Alice and Bob, and we'll talk about clients and servers. So this is the server's public key. Signed by a CA, certificate authority. How do I know the certificate authority's key that signed Bob's public key, the server's public key? That's what comes programmed on my computer, okay? And so this key, the server's public key, is either going to be a signature key or it's going to be an encryption key. If it's a signature key, we're going to do key agreement. And if it's an encryption key, we're going to do key transport. Okay. If we do key agreement, we have a bunch of options that we can do. Okay. We can do Diffie-Hellman, which is denoted DHE, Diffie-Hellman Exchange. There's the EC version of Diffie-Hellman as well. So this is Diffie-Hellman. We need a signature, right? This is a signature scheme, okay? So to sign it, we can either use RSA or DSA. Those are the most common ones. There might be another one. Okay, and inside the signature scheme, we never looked at RSA, but RSA and DSA both have a hash function inside. So you're signing the hash of something, and so you want to specify what hash function you're using. Let me just change this notation a bit. And so the hash function might be MD5, might be SHA-1, 1, 2, or 3. So those are the standard ones. Okay. If you do key transport, you need a public key encryption. ElGamel is only CPA secure, so it's not used. RSA encryption, which I know we didn't talk about, but it's CCA secure, is used. So it's RSA plus some sort of padding. It's not exactly OAAP. They use a sort of older style padding that actually has some problems with it. But anyways, RSA plus padding is used as the encryption scheme. Okay, so that's the sort of first fork that we'll do. The PRG and the extractor uses the hash function. So whatever hash function you use here, it will be used both in the signature and it will also be used for generating all your other values. Okay, so here what we do is we have this sort of shared secret. This will be put through a PRG. So the shared secret is called the master secret. And then we'll get a set of shared keys. Maybe there's one, maybe there's more, depending on what we're going to use with it. And so what we could do is we could use a block cipher. So we might use AES. triple DES, or just DES itself is old. If we do one of these, we're going to need some sort of MAC. So either we'll use GCM, in which case we don't need a MAC, or what we'll do is we'll use some mode of operation. So CBC is the most common, and then we're going to need a MAC as well. Okay. Or we can do a stream cipher. So if we do a stream cipher, we might do CHA-CHA-20, or we might do RC4. Both of these also require a MAC. So CHA-CHA-20, it's common that there's a MAC called Poly-1305, which we didn't talk about, but that's a MAC algorithm that's often used with this cipher suite. If you do RC4, you'll just use a standard HMAC. Okay. So these are all the options you can do in SSL. So SSL is not, this is how you do encryption. You can think of it more as a suite. Okay, there's a whole bunch of different algorithms, and you get to choose which algorithms you want. Why do they do it that way? Well, if there's ever problems with algorithms, then it's easy to add new algorithms to the suite. You can drop your support of certain algorithms that aren't secure. So it gives you some agility. Okay, they could just pick one algorithm to use from top to bottom. But then if there was ever a problem with that one algorithm, then everyone would be in big trouble. Okay, so they went for this approach instead. Where you can sort of negotiate exactly what algorithms you want to use. Okay, so what does this look like in practice? So we can go, for example, this is the course website. And so the course website, you'll see, for example, there's a lock here. Okay, what does that lock mean? That means we are using SSL. Okay, so we're using HTTPS in order to communicate with this. Okay, so this we went through this whole flowchart when we download a copy of the course website. Okay, if I click on it, we'll get some information. So it says Safari's using an encrypted connection to users.encs.concordia.ca. It says a bunch of stuff about encryption, what it does. If I go show certificate, this is Concordia's public key. Okay, so Concordia has a public key, and how did I know that this was actually public? Concordia's public key? Well, it turns out it was signed by this company called GlobalSign, and GlobalSign came on my computer when I bought it for the first time, and before I ever connected to the internet, its public key was sitting on my computer. Okay, the actual public key, if you want to see the details, you can see that they use the keys. It's based on RSA. SHA-256 is the hash algorithm, and then the actual value of the key you can see as well somewhere. So this is actually, sorry, the signature on the key, and then this is the public key itself. Okay, so you can see this is what a public key looks like, and so it just looks like a bunch of numbers. Okay, now. What actually was, when we connected to this website, what did we actually use? Did we use AES? Did we use SHA-256? What were all the parameters that were actually used? So Safari doesn't show it to you. Chrome's a little better. They give you a bit more information. So we'll do the same thing on Chrome. So Chrome, you can see it's secure. You can see they say HTTPS, so you know that we're doing HTTPS. Here, if I click on it, okay. I don't have developer mode set up. But. Oh, and go to inspect. Okay. So this is going to tell us some information. So it says this page is secure, valid HTTPS. We can see the certificate. So GlobalSign was the organization. They signed it. They used SHA-256 when they signed it. Now here's the information about this website itself. So they use TLS 1.2. So that's the newest version. So that's good. They're doing Diffie-Hellman key exchange. It's the elliptic curve version, so that's specified as ECDHE. And the signature that they're using to sign is RSA. Okay, so they're doing station to station signed with RSA. And then this is just about the curve that they're using, which we don't worry about. Then next thing we're going to do is we're negotiating a block cipher to use. So this Diffie-Hellman gets us a shared key. So once we have a shared key, we can use a block cipher or a stream cipher. So in this case, they're opting to use a block cipher, AES, 128 bits, and they're going to use GCM as opposed to using a MAC with it. Okay, so that's what happened to be used when we visited this. Okay, now every website is different. So if we just go to actually base Concordia, see if I can pull up a secure version of it. So the people who run, so this isn't necessarily bad, a really bad thing. So this is better. Okay, so Concordia is not ENCS, so it's a different team is doing it. But you can see we sort of end up with a similar thing. So Komodo is a different certificate authority that signed it. We're still using 1.2. Diffie-Hellman was used. This time, instead of using GCM, they used AES 256 CBC mode, and then they used an HMAC. Okay, so the HMAC they used SHA-1 as the hash function. Chrome doesn't like this, so they note that it's an obsolete cipher. What's obsolete about it is SHA-1. So SHA-1 has these collisions. It's not that critical for HMACs because HMACs don't rely on collision resistance, but anyway, they don't particularly like it. Okay. Now, how is it that when we connected to one site, we ended up with one cipher suite, and when we connected to another site, we ended up with a different cipher suite? How does that actually happen? So what happens is when you connect to a site, Chrome says, hey, this is all the encryption I know about. Okay, I know about all of these, how to talk all of these encryption algorithms. And then the server will say, basically, they'll just pick off the list. So they'll say, well, of all the things that you know about, this is one that I know about that I like the best. So let's go ahead and use that. Okay. Now, if you want to see what every single website's sort of list looks like in terms of things that they support, you can reverse engineer it out. So there's no way to see it, but you can connect to the website repeatedly, like 100 times, and try different algorithms and see if it's willing to do one or another. Then you can do that. So there's a website that's really good called SSL Test that automates that particular process. And then they also give you a lot of information about whether these encryption algorithms are recent or not so recent. So for example, we'll go to users.encs.concordia.ca. And this will take a second because it has to do the full test. Okay, it's going to take a while. While we're waiting for that, I'll fire up a few other websites that we can test. So we can try just concordia.ca. CIBC.com.
What does this
mean? So I'll show you in a sec. It'll be clear when you see the actual results. Yeah, I'll try that. Well, let's do google.com. Probably lots of people have done google.com. So if the website has done it recently, they'll cache it. So this one's fully done and the other ones will run. So they do give you a rating as well. So this is useful if you're setting up an HTTPS site. So the first thing they'll do is they'll talk a bit about the certificate. So who is it that signed Google's key? Where did it come from? It turns out that Google's big enough and powerful enough that they're their own certificate authority. So they just sign their own keys with it. You can see that they have a few different signatures on it. One of them happens to be from this GeoTrust company, and they signed it with SHA-1. This is actually a big deal. If there's collisions in SHA-1, that affects signatures, because if you have two messages that hash the same thing, you're signing that hash, so you're effectively signing both messages at the same time. So that's something you don't want to see. Then in terms of the actual cipher suites, this is what they support. So TLS 1.3, they don't support yet. It's still being standardized. They support 1.2, 1.1, 1.0. They don't support 3 or 2. Okay. 1.0, you'll probably never negotiate it, but basically for legacy clients that don't support 1.2, they want to be able to still have those people visit Google. They don't want to say that you're not allowed to visit Google, so that's why they support it. Here's all their cipher suites that they support, and these are ordered in their preference. So if you come talk to them, they're going to try and negotiate you to use this. And the only reason that you won't use this is because you don't support it. Your phone doesn't support it. Your browser doesn't support it. You have some old computer, whatever the case may be. Then they'll try the second thing on the list, then the third thing on the list, and they'll keep going down. Okay. So what's the first thing on the list? So the first thing on the list is Diffie-Hellman over elliptic curves with a signature scheme, which is DSA. Okay, the elliptic curve of DSA, which is ECDSA. Okay. Then they're going to use AES GCM. Okay, so GCM has a Mac built in. You only need one key, so that's very efficient. And they're going to use SHA-256 as their hash function for it. Okay, so that's their most preferred suite. Their next preferred one is going to use Diffie-Hellman with ECDSA. Then they're going to use a stream cipher, so they're going to use SHA-20. They're going to use this Mac algorithm, which is Poly 1305, and they're going to use SHA-256 with it. Okay, then as you go down, you'll see that eventually, they'll do Diffie-Hellman with RSA signatures instead. Then they'll go to key transport eventually. And for key transport, they'll do RSA encryption. And then they'll do AES GCM, or they might do CBC mode with SHA-1 as your particular cipher suite. There is one that's weak here, which is RSA key transport with triple DES. So triple DES is that older block cipher. But once again, I want to emphasize that you'll only ever use this if your client basically says no to all of these things. Then you'll eventually go down to this. Okay. Now, another thing is you'll see that they add this FS to some of these. FS stands for forward secure or forward secrecy. So like we said, DHE has forward secrecy, but key transport doesn't. Okay. So these all have forward secrecy. But then when we switch to RSA, which is key transport, we don't have forward secrecy anymore. Okay. Then what they do is they go through a bunch of clients. So if you happen to be running Windows XP with IE version 8, this is what you would end up with. Okay. If you have an Android phone, but you haven't upgraded in a while, then you're going to end up with this cipher suite or whatever the case may be. Okay. So they'll go through the different permutations. Then there's a bunch of attacks on SSL, and so they'll go through, Heartbleed and RC4 biases and Poodle and Beast and a bunch of these things. These are things that we didn't really talk about in class. You might be doing a project on one of those things, but otherwise it would tell you if they're vulnerable to those particular attacks, okay? And then they add it all up, and then they give you a rating. So Google, obviously, they're in the business of security. They have tons of security engineers, and so they're going to get a good rating. Not every website gets a good rating. So this is Concordia. So users.encs.concordia.ca. So you can see it looks very similar. So they're going to only do DHE. Okay, so they're not going to even support key transport. So it's going to be forward secure all the way down. And then they have different things. There's this Camellia, which is a different block cipher. So that's a little bit strange, but otherwise everything looks kind of the same. Concordia.ca gets an F. Okay. Maybe don't know what they're doing. This happens every year without fail. So let's see what happens here. Okay, so Their Cypher suites, well, let's just go see what the problem is. So they support 1.2, 1.1, 1.0, so that's all fine. There's no problem there. In terms of their Cypher suites, they all look good. They have a forward secure option. They do key transport. So this is GCM. This is CVC mode. So there's no problem. They're not using anything old. They used to actually use older things, so they have updated their preferences. You can see that they don't support a lot of Cypher suites, so there's actually a pretty good chance that maybe you don't support one of these six values. And so you can see that there are a bunch of clients, like old versions of Android, IE8, some Java stuff, that actually fail to connect to Concordia. It looks like there's this Poodle attack. I won't go into the details of it, but they haven't done any mitigation of Poodle. So it looks like that's actually why they got the F. It wasn't because they had anything that was like sort of obscenely bad in terms of their Cypher suites. Does anyone have a favorite website that they want to see tested? We can look at some bad ones. Well, so you can see they added Concordia to the recent worst ones. I don't know. You mean T here? Yeah, I don't know what that is. I mean, we can click on it and see. Trust issues are ignored. I guess it means that there is some issue in the certificate, not in the Cypher suites itself.
Try it, guys.
Okay, I'll try that in a sec. So here's one that's old. Why is this one bad? Well, they're using SHA-1, which is weak. They use TripleDES. TripleDES isn't the worst algorithm, but it's not particularly good. But anyways, TripleDES and SHA-1 isn't a good combination. They also have, okay, so this is interesting. So padding Oracle vulnerability, that's actually exactly what you're looking at for assignment 2. Okay, so this website is vulnerable to that particular attack. It's probably because they don't support the latest version of TLS. Yeah, so they do. Yeah, I'm not sure what it is in their implementation that makes them vulnerable, but that makes sense. Yeah, so a phishing website is not protected from SSL. So I want to be very clear that if you have a lock here, what does that mean? It means that you know that you're actually talking to ssllabs.com. So if you go to Google with 3 O's, you can still have a lock and you can still have a secure connection. All SSL is guaranteeing you is that you are actually talking to Google with 3 O's. They're not guaranteeing that you're talking to Google, the company in Mountain View, California. Right. So if you want to combat phishing, which is, you know, a website that looks like another website, then SSL won't. It's not trying to solve that problem, or at least in actuality, it doesn't solve that problem. The original design back in the 90s when they came up with it was that it would actually solve that problem. But for a variety of reasons that we actually talk about in 6150, that it ended up not solving that particular case. Okay, questions about this? Okay, so you can see the entire course basically in this one line of code or Cypher suite specification. Basically, you know, we started with hash functions and then we talked about modes of operation. So you can see all the different modes of operations. Talk about block ciphers versus stream ciphers. We talked about RSA versus EC, DHE, and DSA and all that stuff, okay? And then buried inside of this, even though you're not negotiating it, there are PRGs, there are extractors that are used inside this particular protocol. So literally every little thing in the course, all of that goes into making this lock appear beside a website when you go and visit a particular website. Okay, let me put this in the notes so that we have something to reference. Yeah, and so here, actually, I see it in the screenshot. It says the server is vulnerable to Poodle, where grade is set to F. So that was the reason why, basically, they got an F. In past years, it was actually a lot worse. I can actually, let me pull up the notes from last year just for interest. So this is what it looked like last year. So it was also an F. But last year, Concordia had all sorts of cipher suites that were out of date. So this is RSA key transport with RC4. RC4 has a bunch of problems with it. And then MD5 is also a really old hash algorithm. So that was like the top thing. So not only was it insecure, but it was the server preferred that. So they would actually try to connect to you with this. And you wouldn't end up, even though there were secure options below, you wouldn't end up actually negotiating them because this was preferred. And then you can see some other combinations that were secure as well. Okay, so that's everything. What questions do you have? So CBC is the mode of operation. AES is the encryption algorithm itself that's used. Yeah, so you absolutely need both. And this is also a sort of pet peeve of mine is sometimes you'll go out and people will say, oh, we're using AES encryption. That actually doesn't mean anything until you tell me the mode of operation. If you're using AES ECB, that's really, really bad. If you're using AES GCM, that's really, really good. So yeah, you need to specify both. Yeah, so that's all you need to know. Yeah, so I won't go into the details. GCM is very complicated. I think I highlighted why. And yeah, it's more like a project. So some people will probably do their project report on that. Sort of the level. Okay, other questions? Okay, then. Well, it's been fun. Thank you very much. And good luck studying for the exam. You are dismissed. Yes, sir.